Welcome to Back Porch Chats,
where we have conversations about hope, grace, and recovery.
Our mission is to shape 12-step communities where sponsors and sponsees support each other to move beyond the shame of abuse.
We are dedicated to sharing knowledge about the connection between addiction and sexual abuse with people who are struggling to stop their destructive compulsive behavior.
Are you ready to embrace freedom from your past trauma?
And help others do the same? If so, grab a cup of coffee.
And join the conversations on the back porch with Vince.
And Gina.
All right. Welcome back. We have a wonderful, wonderful guest with us today. But before we do that, you got your cup of coffee, Gina?
I got my cup of coffee.
All right. Great. Me too. Welcome to the back porch here for another chat about grace, hope, and recovery. Today, we have Dr. Camilla Williams with us. She has got some experience in helping people recover from childhood sex abuse trauma. She has had the opportunity to work with both addicts and non-addicts and dealing with trauma, people in the military who've been traumatized. So I'm going to take it this time and turn this over to Gina and let Gina start the interview with our guest today, Dr. Camilla Williams.
Hey, Camilla, how you doing?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to have you on. I did a little research on you. It seems like you've done quite a bit of work on trauma and perfectionism. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I am a board certified psychologist, and I've had over a decade of experience working with veterans with trauma. And in the last 5 years, I've really specialized in working with people with a history of sexual abuse. And really starting to see perfectionism is kind of one of those common denominators that a lot of my clients just struggled with as a result of the traumas that they had gone through.
Yeah, you know, I'm probably one of those guilty of that. I bought my podcasting equipment over a year ago, and it's taken me this long because I was freaked out about being perfect with the podcast. Can you tell me, I have a history of sexual child abuse, and what I was reading about it is that there is this big connection. Can you tell me what that connection is?
Yeah, so when you grow up in, I'm going to use the phrase, just a harsh environment, because people have different kinds of harsh environments that they grow up in. It can be physical abuse, sexual abuse, it can be neglect. It can be really harsh criticism from parents with very exacting standards. But it basically kind of puts you in that survival mode. That's what trauma does. It puts you in the sense of, for some people, it's either that fight or flight, right? I'm going to fight back or run away. But for a lot of people, it's actually freeze. It's the sense of like you're kind of frozen, you're stuck, and you're just trying to minimize the pain. So what perfectionism does, and it can start at such a young age, is the sense of you begin to learn that if I can do everything just right, I won't get hurt. And that's really where it starts, right? Because if I don't know if mom or dad are going to yell at me or hit me or punish me, but if I can keep everything clean and I can do all my homework and I'm not getting in trouble, no one's going to yell at me, no one's going to hit me. So it can start at that just basic level of if I can do it right, I won't get hurt. But what happens between kids and parents too, it goes an extra step of in order to get love and acceptance and praise, it kind of only happens when I do really, really well. And that's where like those perfectionistic high standards, like if I want to get love and praise and attention, I have to really perform and do amazing. And that's when I finally get that little bit of love and attention and praise from my caregiver, whether it's mom, dad, a grandma, or a teacher I look up to. And so that can also ingrain that tendency towards perfectionism. So it's as a way to prevent getting judged and criticized and as a way to get praise and love and acceptance.
You know, Camilla, in my working with people, I've found that a lot of times these things such as perfectionism where actually survival skills that helped us get by a very troubling toxic childhood, only as adults to stop working and being counterproductive. Have you found that to be true?
Absolutely. One of the ways I conceptualize and think about perfectionism is it's about control. And so control in three different ways. I'm trying to control my emotions. I'm trying to control how other people see me. And I'm trying to control the outcomes or results of things. And survival really comes into play in trying to control outcomes and results, which is if I do everything just right, then it'll be okay. Then I will be safe. Then I won't get hurt. And so it's really like I'm really trying to control, especially if you come from an environment where you have no control, right? You can't control when dad's going to fly off the lid. You can't control when mom's going to go into a manic episode. You have so little control over what happens in your home environment that as a way to survive, kids really kind of double down on what is in their control, and they can become very obsessive over things like their schoolwork or their athletic performance or their cleanliness or their eating.
You mentioned the freeze, and I'm sitting here trying to process that. I know, and this might get into the addiction aspect of it, I know that when I first started drinking, right before I started drinking, really, I was having a freeze problem. And I went to a therapist and I said, I don't understand what's wrong with me. I make all the decisions and suddenly I can't make any. I don't know what to do. And she said that was the first time I heard of anything other than fight or flight. She says that's because you froze. You can't make a decision because you don't make any, don't know what decision to make. You don't know what the perfect decision is.
Mm-hmm.
And so you choose to make none. And that was it. I didn't know what to do. So I chose to make none.
Yeah, and it's automatic and instinctual. It's like there's a part of your body that just knows, like you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? I'm not strong enough to fight back, and I'm not quick enough to run away, so I'm going to shut down to try to minimize the pain and just survive. And that's what children do. They can't fight back against their abusers because they're just kids. They can't run away. They have nowhere to go. They're just kids. So they go into this freeze, this shutdown, where the mind emotionally is trying to protect itself from experiencing pain, emotional pain and physical pain. And that's that freeze response. And that's why you see this lead into addiction so often, because one way to initiate that shutting down and numbing of all that emotional pain is to use substances.
That's crazy. I'm in awe, because that is exactly what happened with me. I mean, I had so much. I was raising two kids and I was married, and I was running 4-H and dealing with school and going to school and dealing with the kids at school and PTA, and I was doing everything. And then suddenly I hit a point where I just couldn't make any decisions, and I don't know what triggered it, but it just like 20 years of everything going great, and then all of a sudden it's wrong. And listening to you talk, this is the hit. You know, this is the one thing that hit, and oh my gosh, that's wild. Yeah, and then the next thing I did is started drinking and developed a problem with alcoholism.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that people don't always realize, because when you think of perfectionists, right, you kind of tend to think of that high achiever who's just go, 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 and has their whole life together, but a lot of times it's kind of like a shield. Like everything I'm doing is a little shield that I put up to protect myself from the outside world. And on the inside, I can feel a bit like of an imposter. Like if anybody really saw what a mess I was internally, they wouldn't believe it. And in trying to keep all those things going, right, I have to be a good mom and I have to be good at work and I got to do this and I have to do that, and trying to do everything perfectly, all that stress and all that pressure, a lot of times the only outlet that people find is turning to substances. How do I deal with that pressure? Oh, I'll have a drink. That'll take the edge off. And then it tends to spiral out of control from there.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Yes, and this kind of and just the inside of that dynamic you just explained is the fact that we shut our feelings down so hard, both the good and the painful feelings, both the fear and the love and the shame, and we shut all that down, and we drink to numb that and push that away, but we also drink to feel something euphoric too. So it's really a catch 22 there. We try to make ourselves happy and euphoric, which we can't you can't choose whether you're going to feel your pain or just your joy. You got to feel them all.
Yeah. And there's, you know, when I was talking about perfectionism, right, controlling others' perceptions or feelings and outcomes, it's about controlling our feelings. And so perfectionists actually kind of really suck at dealing with uncomfortable emotions. And that's one of the reasons why perfectionists really struggle with procrastination.
Yes.
Because it's a sense of, I am so afraid of feeling like a failure or just feeling like I'll procrastinate. I'm going to keep putting it off because every time I procrastinate, I get a little bit of a relief of, okay, I don't have to do this right now. Even though I know it's going to snowball and get worse later on. So we're, you know, they're really not good at feeling emotions. But you mentioned that piece of, you know, when you numb out the negative emotions, you also numb out the positive. And that's why sometimes the only time you can feel euphoric is when you're high. There's a biology to that. And I like to ask people, give a little exercise to my clients of to describe physically, how do you feel when you're anxious, angry, or like lustfully excited, right? So I'm like, think about the 17-year-old who just got asked to prom by their crush and they're so excited that their crush is asking them out. My heart is racing, my palms are sweaty, my stomach is in butterflies, my cheeks are flushed. I can't believe, you know, it's that excitement. When I'm anxious, right, like going over, you know, a super high bridge, that I'm afraid it's the same thing. My palms are sweaty, my cheeks are flushed, my stomach is in knots, my breathing is fast. And when I'm pissed off, right, the computer isn't working and I want to chuck it out the window, my cheeks are flushed, my palms are sweaty, my stomach is in knots, and my breathing is fast, and my muscles are tense. And so physically, when you just think about those three emotions, that excitement, that lust, anxiety, and anger, it manifests physically the same in the body. So when you're trying to shut down the negative, which is the anxiety and the anger, you mm-hmm. also shut down the positive, which would be the mm-hmm. excitement and the lust. And that's why you have a general numbing across the board.
Yeah.
You'd say it.
And I was just thinking as you were talking there, Camille, about explaining all that. I feel the same way when I slam down four donuts. that same feeling, clammy.
I was just gonna say the same feeling with sex.
Or when you fall in love, you know. I've worked with some cutters, but I want to imagine that if you're somebody that cuts yourself or that same pain, it's kind of the opposite. I want to feel something, and this is the way to feel.
Yeah, it's a way to feel something, anything, and it's also a way to focus. I know a lot of cutters I've worked with, there's so much going on that when they do that, it gives them a focal point to really hone in their attention because they can't stop their minds from racing and ruminating about everything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've had my experience with cutting and without a doubt, people ask why you do it. And it's like, so I can feel something. And this feels better than the emotional pain that I'm feeling. So I'd rather deal with the physical pain, but I need to feel something because I don't know what to feel otherwise. So
yeah.
Well, all right, Camilla, you've done a great job of kind of explaining all of this dynamic in this process. The definition of the problem is not any good if we don't know what to do about it. So when you receive somebody that's working this way and you start working with them, from a view from 10,000 feet, if you will, what does recovery from this kind of look like in your clients?
Yeah. You know, I really am all for, so perfectionists really have this all or nothing thinking, right?
Right.
So I can see a perfectionist already, and this is one of the reasons perfectionists actually sabotage their recovery more often than not, is because you're entering recovery with this, I have to do everything. Tell me everything I need to do, doc, and I'll do everything, and it gets overwhelming, it seems way too daunting, and you're more likely to relapse and just kind of throw your hands in the air and be like, oh, screw it, I can't do all of this. And so really just the first step, you got to watch out for that all or nothing and really look at that idea of progress, not perfection, right? You focus on staying sober one day at a time is really the most important first step when I'm working with clients. But then in the longer run, what I also want to help them get to, it's that at the core of perfectionism and trauma in general is shame. And it's this feeling that I am broken, that I'm worthless, that I'm not good enough. And you tend to create a life where you're trying to protect yourself from feeling that sense of not good enough. And so you're less likely to try things or take risks, because what if I try and I fail? Then it's proof that I'm not good enough. So you end up playing small. And by playing small, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy of, see, I am worthless. I am not good enough. And you kind of get stuck in that spiral. So really learning, and this is why I say, like, for especially people who struggle with addiction, you need to work through the trauma and the shame. We got to work through that. We have to process it, whether you're doing it in a group or with a sponsor or with a therapist. We got to shine a light on that shame. Otherwise, it won't go away.
Good. And in your experience, we're obviously 12-step group oriented here, and we like the 12 steps. And we can talk a little bit about, I want to talk a little bit about the role of the 12 steps in that healing process, the reducing of the shame. But what about the community of the 12 steps? Is that something you found to be important?
Absolutely. And so the thing with that shame of not feeling good enough or afraid that you're worthless is we tend to keep it a secret. And we're so afraid that people are going to find out. And that's one of the most powerful things about the AA community is every time you open up and share and you don't get kicked out, right? Like, I just told them this and no one kicked me out. Why didn't they kick me out? And it's like, it challenges that thought, right? That if people find out, I'm going to be rejected. And it's like, no, they're welcoming back next week. Wait, they want me to come back? And that is so healing. And that's why I love these kinds of groups and community, because that's really the most powerful thing in overcoming that sense of worthlessness and shame. And so I always encourage all of my clients, like, you need to be vulnerable and you need to practice that vulnerability in a safe place. And an AA group is supposed to be that safe place to practice that.
Yeah, it's been my experience, my 26 years of experience, that all 12-step groups can be safe. There's some that are pretty shut down, and especially if you want to sit there and talk about something such as sex abuse, childhood sex abuse and stuff. So I work with my people to really find a place that is accepting of that and allow that. And then I also have to work with my people that they don't have to go in and share a bunch of details. They can just stay general in nature and get enough of it to get that love and acceptance. So it's some of that's kind of learning how to be appropriate. I know early on in recovery, I wasn't appropriate all the times. I blurted everything. But later on.
And absolutely. That's something that I, when I do seeking safety groups and I try to teach people, like, you really have to learn to just share a little bit. Because if you're not used to sharing, there can be a tendency to kind of just like unload everything all at once. And then what happens is Brené Brown kind of calls it a shame hangover. It's like, I said way too much too soon. I wasn't ready for it. And now I am too ashamed to face you again. And they don't come back to the group or they don't come back to therapy. So you're absolutely right that you need to kind of practice opening up little by little, just for yourself, so that you get practice working through those emotions, and also to test out the group and see if it is a safe place to share that with them.
And if it's not, find you another one. That's what I
exactly, I
tell my people. I also know that that when my people, the first couple of times they tell their story, I build in an appointment with them, coffee or dinner or something the next day, because I tell them, you're going to have a shame blast. After you tell your story, you're going to get raw. So let's just go ahead and plan for that and deal with that.
That's beautiful. I'm so glad you have that built in, because that's exactly what happened. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, the 12 steps themselves, Camilla, they, you know, we start off with powerlessness and a power greater than ourselves. And one of the things I love about 12-step programs, we get to decide what that power is. We don't have any one thing jammed down our throat. But we get to the fourth step, which is we take an inventory. And sometimes that's where perfectionism really can be a problem when you're working with somebody, because they want to, they hear, if you're not thorough, you'll drink again. So they want to write down everything that they've ever done and get it perfect and slam it in. And they'll stay there a year. And I try to tell my people, stuck on the fourth step for a year is torture. You're just torturing yourself.
I'm over here laughing because it's been 2 years, and that's exactly what I've done. I haven't done the fourth step because I have notebooks upon notebooks upon notebooks of my resentments.
And I tell them the release starts in the fifth step when we tell God, another, and ourselves. We reveal those. So
yeah.
So and a lot of people think that the moral inventory is about us listing all of our sexual shame out there, and being somebody that's worked with people that are sexually recovered. And I found, no, it's not that. And I got my own idea about what the fourth step really needs to be. I was just wondering, how do you help that with your people?
And so that fourth step, especially if you struggle with perfectionism, you need a sounding board. And the problem is that when perfectionists are trying to do it all by themselves, because of their what I call unrelenting high standards, that the average person typically would be like, are you insane? Like, no one can live up to that. They get lost in that inner critic, right? That inner critic and that sense of blame and shame. And so you have to have a sounding board, which is a trusted other person that you can bounce ideas off. Because sometimes just saying it out loud to someone, because that's what I'll do with clients. Clients will tell me something and I will reflect back in their exact words. I might change my intonation a little bit. And they're like, well, when you say it like that, it sounds, extreme. I'm like, because it is. You're holding yourself to such a high standard. You're blaming yourself. You're taking on all this responsibility and you're not really that all powerful.
Yes.
And so it can be really helpful to have someone else to kind of bounce it off, like, what are the moral standards that I'm holding myself to? Because one of the thoughts I come back to over and over again with my clients is this idea of, I did the best I could with what I knew then. I'm judging my past self based on all the knowledge I have right now. And I'm like, but put yourself back in your shoes, right? That 19-year-old you who was abused and is suffering and is just trying to make all that pain go away. Did you know then what you know now? And it's like, no, I didn't. Were you doing the best you could at that moment? Mm-hmm. And it's always, yes, I was doing the best I could at that moment. I didn't have any other tools or skills or support or resources to help me get through it. And so when you get stuck in that blame or shame, I always go back to, you gotta remind yourself exactly of what you knew back then. And have some compassion, some self-compassion.
I did that the other day. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter and an 8-year-old granddaughter. And I was thinking about them and their reaction to what had happened to me. And they both would have been deer in headlights and no one would have blamed them. And I think that's something that's really key that people can do that they don't do. I was talking to someone else the other day as well, and he said he was 10 years old when it happened. And I says, so why do you blame yourself? Because I could have controlled it. And I said, now find yourself a 10-year-old boy and imagine, could he have controlled that? And the answer is obviously no. There's no way. Someone twice your size, twice your weight, twice your knowledge with the manipulation skills that they have, there's no way you can control that.
Yeah. I had a client, she, veteran, super strong, went through all the boot camps, all the special ops training, had martial arts things under her belt. Like, she was so strong, and she kept blaming herself for her assault, saying, I should have fought back, right? It's just like, I have all this training, like, why didn't I fought back? And when we were doing the processing together, there was a moment there where she's like, and I froze. And I'm like, wait, let's go back to that moment. Tell me a little bit more about it. And she's like, I knew in my gut, like this visceral, instinctual thing in my gut, that if I fought back harder, he would kill me. So I froze. And I kept coming back to that moment with her over and over because she was blaming herself. I should have done better. I knew better. I knew better. Why didn't I fight harder? And it's like, because your survival instinct kicked in. You knew in your gut that if you fought harder, he could kill you. So you froze. And getting her to a place to kind of put herself back in that moment of, you know, she was doing all the woulda, coulda, shouldas. It's like, no, in that moment, I did the best I could.
Well, even, I like to tell my people on situations, not only did you do the best you could, you made decisions that helped you to survive it.
You survived
yes. it. Hooray for you. You're courageous. You got through it.
Yes.
So now let's deal with it and move on. But
thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank yourself for what you did because you survived.
Yeah, you did the best you could, and you survived. Like, that's the goal, right?
Yeah,
the goal is to survive. And when I talk about, like, emotions that people work through, like, if you're trying to kind of gauge where you are in your recovery process and dealing with trauma, usually in the beginning, you're struggling with blame and shame.
Mm-hmm.
If you've gotten through that, you kind of then move into anger, because now you're finally angry at the right people for what happened to you. And once you move through the anger, you end up in the grief. And that's usually actually the longest and the hardest, because you can't fast forward through grief. You just have to learn to live through it and live with it. But once you get to that stage of grief and you can work through that, you know, as a psychologist, like, I see that, like, okay, this is someone who really is on their way to recovery, because they finally worked through all those emotions, and they're kind of at this stage now that they can start thinking about, how do I want my life to be like moving forward?
Yes, I've found for me, working with the fourth step, we go back, and John Bradshaw in his book on healing toxic shame, healing the toxic shame that binds, he talks about the hierarchy of emotions, that anger covers up fear, and fear covers up shame, and shame covers up the grief. And I can remember when I first started talking about that in 12-step meetings, people would say, well, that's nowhere in the big book. That's not in there. And over the years, I looked at it, and I went back and read some of that. No, that comes right out of the big book, because when we get into the fourth step, the real way to do it, the simple way and the best way to do it early on in recovery and in codependence and stuff, we do it a little bit different, a little more in depth. But early on, you know, the first thing we deal with is our bitterness and resentments. Well, that's our anger gone awry.
Mm-hmm.
That's our anger that we're not using in a healthy way. So we deal with our bitterness and resentments. The next thing in there is our fear. We deal with our fear. But really what we're dealing with is our anxiety and our paranoia. Once again, fear that's gone awry. And then the next thing we deal with is the shame. And we get in the sixth and seventh step where we realize we can't fix this problem by ourselves. We have to have help from other people, higher powers and stuff to do this. And then, you know, we get into the eighth and ninth step where we make amends. Well, there we at the shame. So we're cleaning up the shame. And then you get into the 11th step where you pray for God's will and the power that to carry that out. And grief is basically learning that we're not going to get something we wanted, or we're not going to get something, that we're going to lose something we had, or we're not going to get something we want. So there's the grief. And so it's all in there. But until we deal with the false anger, until we deal with the anxiety and the paranoia, the healing starts in the shame, and the relief starts in the grief, is what I found. And you got to get past all that and get down to that relief and grief work. And here I am over-talking because you're the expert. But that's just what is resonating inside of me with what you're saying, is what I have found that to be true.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's right. Why might someone relapse? Is you get to the grief area and you're just not ready for it.
No, the shame. Right. You can't even get through the shame without relapsing.
Yeah. And so it's like, I don't want to feel this, and I know exactly what can numb it out. So being, and so it's like, even just being able to identify the emotions, right? That's why so much of the work you do in the groups and with your sponsors is just to learning to put the right label. What is my feeling right now? It, like you said, it starts out with anger because that's a safer emotion. It feels a little bit more safer and empowering to be angry than to admit that there's hurt or fear underneath
right.
it. But you gotta get better at really pinpointing what is it that I'm feeling right now so that you can start to address it and work through it.
Well, and I have found in my own life that living life from the viewpoint of the victim, that bitterness and resentment is really being a victim, and drama mm-hmm. and chaos, and all of that can be very medicated, like you were talking about earlier. That is not a very good high, but it can still be avoiding that responsibility and being the victim. So,
yeah, and the victimhood, it kind of goes back to that all or nothing again.
Yeah.
Right, which is if I have no control over what happens to me, then, right, might as well just throw my hands up and, like, I'm the victim. There's nothing I can do, and you got to address that all or nothing thinking and really start by focusing on, like, you do have some control. Let's start there. What can you control in your life today?
Yes, yes. And we're kind of moving a little bit late into the time there. But I know one thing that I wanted to talk about is as a sponsor, a non-professional, mm-hmm. I'm a retired band director. So when we didn't cover yeah. sex abuse in band directing school very long, though we probably should have. But a different story. As a sponsor, when do you get a professional involved?
So listen to your gut instincts, right? Because when you're working with someone and you've worked with so many different people, you have kind of that gut instinct of, is this person at risk for relapsing? Because that lets you know that they're a little bit overextended in terms of how many their resources that's available to them, and they might need a little bit more help from a professional. And so if they're opening up to you and you are starting to wonder, like, maybe this is emotionally overwhelming, they're going to be at risk for relapsing or for self-harm, I would definitely try to get them connected with a professional just to have that extra support. Because the thing is, if you're a sponsor and you're always listening to all these stories from people and you yourself aren't getting support, it can burn out mm-hmm. and it can be re-triggering for you yourself. Yes. That would be kind of my second gauge, is if you are personally feeling at your limit,
beautiful,
by all means, refer them to a professional. Because, right, as a sponsor, you're not trained to hold all, contain all these emotions and all these stories. Mm-hmm. You're there to provide support, but you don't have the same level of training and support that someone who's working in a professional capacity does. So listening to your gut, if you feel like the person you're sponsoring is at risk of relapsing, listening to your own well-being, and if you're feeling like it's a little bit too much for you and it's stretching you a little bit too thin, then you want to refer.
That's beautiful.
I hope that made sense.
Yeah, that I like that, and paying attention to your own internal emotions and giving. I would love to have you back on and explore that. And how do you choose a qualified therapist? Not all therapists are created equal. You need to be careful with if you're going to tap into a professional, So if you would, maybe you'd come back on and we could talk about that.
Yeah, I would love to. I definitely have my thoughts and opinions about that.
I love that. Yes. Well, we are going to have to wrap this up. You got anything you want to add, Ms. Jen?
Yeah, I wanted to let you know that some show notes will be in to tell you how to contact or get a hold of Camilla, and that'll be in our description. And thank you very much, Camilla, for coming on the show. I really loved having you here.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.